I am telling my son that there is a coral reef circling the island, that the seabed is quite shallow until you get out there, when I feel the sandy bottom of the sea fall out beneath my feet. I pedal my legs, treading water, keeping us afloat. My son is still talking in my ear, still holding on to my shoulders, unaware that we are now no longer walking. I eye our destination, the platform. I estimate that I can probably make it. The man we met said it was walkable after all, didn't he? Maybe I've just hit a deep patch, a hollow, and I'll find higher ground again. So I continue, swimming now, with my son on my back. He has been having lessons back at home, lining up on the side of a London pool with the other children, bathing caps on. I am always able to pick him out by the shape of his neck, the arch of his brow, the stoically anxious expression on his face as he rises out of the chlorinated water. He can do half a width, he can float on his back, he can retrieve plastic sharks from the pool floor. What he can't do yet is swim, here, in open water like this. I swim and swim, my arms working, my legs kicking behind me. I focus my gaze on the platform, which is rising and falling before me, its silver steps leading up to safety. Every now and again, I stretch down my leg to see if I can touch the bottom. I can't. I keep swimming. The muscles in my arms and legs are burning, tiring. My son clings to my shoulders, oblivious, chatting, exclaiming. I have to keep reminding him to kick his legs, like his swimming teacher taught him, to help me out. He can't swim, is what is going round and round in my head. He can't swim. He can't swim, and I brought him out here because of what someone told me. He can't swim, and I brought him out into deep sea on the advice of an idiot. Actually, it's me who is the idiot. I grew up near the coast with a lifelong sea swimmer for a father who would call out to us when we were paddling or practicing front crawl in the shallows of the Irish Sea the same sentence, "Stay in your depth." Always those words would ring in my ears, "Stay in your depth." But being the child I used to take great pleasure in stepping just that little bit too far, feeling the stones and sand of Donegal beaches fall away from my toes until I'd hear his voice calling me back. I should know better. Have I never heard of tides, of water depth changing, of the sea's unpredictability, of sandbanks that dip suddenly and steeply away? Have I allowed myself to be so lulled, so infantilized by the ever-present, always anticipated service of this luxury resort that I have surrendered my free will, my judgment? What kind of a mother am I, putting myself and my child in danger like this? I am chiding myself, cursing myself as I swim, flailing now, all notion of strokes gone, just trying to stay afloat. I go under, the weight of my child pressing me down, but I struggle back and I hear my son still talking. It seems very important not to let on, not to communicate to him that we are in trouble, that we might not make it. I don't need to turn my head to know that my husband is too far away to help, and how could he leave the sleeping baby anyway? If he dived in to rescue us, she might wake up, she might cry, she might, God forbid, crawl towards the water. All in all, it is an impossible situation, and I am the worst kind of idiot. What I would give now to be back on the beach, to be back at home, in London, with both my children safe and sound, never to have seen this place, this beach, this distant platform, never to have met that guest who told us we could walk it, never to have loitered with him by the breakfast buffet. I go under again, my arms now so weak that they have no traction on the water. I have no muscle strength, no stamina. I have damaged quadriceps, inhibited reflexes, enervated bi and triceps. What was I thinking? We're going under. It's happening. My eyes smart with salt. My head is subsumed by choking, foamy sea. Is my son above the waterline or is he down here with me? I can't tell. What I see, however, through the greenish sunshot depths of the saline water, is the base of a ladder. Two silver steps, which appear, then disappear, appear, then disappear. I give a kick with my legs, two. I stretch out my hand, I miss, I kick again, stretch, and this time I reach it. I grasp the bottom rung, I pull myself towards it, I haul us up out of the water. The light, the noise of the waves, the sound of my son still incredibly talking rush in on me. He climbs off me and up the ladder onto the platform, where he runs from one side to the other, exclaiming. I hook my arms around the ladder and breathe and breathe and breathe. Cerebellum, 1980. Just before the end of the summer holidays, I woke up early, and the world looked different. The colours of the rug, the curtains, the lampshade were more vibrant. They were pulsing, like a heart, like a sea anemone. The bedroom appeared to be suddenly at an angle, the floor tilting, the windows cantilevering into the outside. The ceiling was like a film of floating liquid above me, a distant and blurred meniscus, and I was far below in some mysterious depth. Nothing was static. Everything shimmered and shifted. I had the sense that my sister in the lower bunk was miles away. For a while I lay there, arms by my sides, and took it in. The light, the colour, the motion. Oh, brave new world. After watching my bedroom dissolving and reforming, I went to get up, but when I raised myself off the pillow, a sensation burst open inside my head. It was a pain so severe, so pure, that it was as if someone was sounding a high soprano chord somewhere behind my eyes. It was a pain that stretched my head to bursting point, as if my skull was a balloon overfilled with water. It was a pain that had colours. White, yellow, streaks and jags of red, and a personality. It was like being in the company of a needy, irascible person who insisted on embracing me too tightly, yacking in my ear, who never left me alone for a moment, who took over my life, who spoke for me and never let me go. I have never felt pain like it, before or since. It was edgeless. It was perfect, the way the shell of an egg is perfect. And it was invasive, colonizing. It sought, I knew, to take me over, to replace me with itself, like a bad spirit, like a fiend. A day or so later, the pain intensified, gained strength and focus, and it seemed to me that my hands were acquiring minds of their own. They began to waver and swing, like the limbs of the tow-headed dirndl-wearing puppet that hung from our bedroom ceiling. I reached across the sink for my toothbrush, and somehow my hand connected instead with the wall, with the air, with the wall again. I tried to pick up a pencil, but my fingers refused to grip. Messages from my brain, from the part of myself I then thought of as my soul, didn't seem to be reaching the relevant limb. Transmission lost. Look, I said to my mum, look at this. By the time the GP came, and he came to the house, on a rare and urgent home visit, an uncontrollable tremor had gripped my legs, my neck, my head, my arms. What I remember with a needling clarity is being summoned downstairs to see the doctor. I took the stairs a step at a time. The GP, a man who had known me since I was little, stood watching, attentive, stock still, his bag in his hand, my mother beside him. Neither spoke as I came down towards them, my legs buckling under me, my hand flailing for the banister. Their faces floated in my field of vision. The swirled orange and brown hall carpet behind them, the light coming in through the opaque glass of the front door, the grey beige of the doctor's mac, the thin gold strand of his pocket watch stretching over the front of his waistcoat. As I reached the last stair, he turned to my mother and said, "You need to take her to hospital." Shortly afterwards, I was lying on the examination couch of a consultant paediatrician. He asked me to grip his forefinger as hard as I could, to follow the path of a small torch, to touch my nose with my thumb, to place my left hand on my right shoulder. He touched each of my feet and asked, left or right? He smiled at me, even though I got everything wrong. And then he told my parents to drive me to the neurology department of the National Hospital in Cardiff. Did I know the danger I was in as I sat in the back of the car, wrapped in a crocheted blanket, on my way to the big hospital, as I watched the city reel past the car windows? Now that I have children of my own, I view this scene with an altered perspective. I am aware of the panic my parents must have felt on that drive. I can taste it. And as they carried me in through the automatic doors of that hospital, as they sat in the office of the neurologist, as they watched me being admitted and wheeled away. I have no memory of how my parents behaved, whether they let their feelings show. I was locked inside a casket of pain, of fever. I remember the neurologist's room much larger than the kind doctor's, the toys stacked up in baskets, a particular purple dressing gown with a fuzzy nap to it, the silver watches pinned upside down to the nurse's chests, the way they patted my inner arm to bring up the veins, the pinch and then the sucking drawer of the blood test, the cochineal shock of what appeared in the syringe. Did I sense my peril when relatives arrived from far away to see me, to stand beside my bed and look down on me, or when two doctors from Great Ormond Street in London were summoned to examine me, or during the lumbar puncture, when I was turned onto my side and held down while they drew fluid from my spinal column, the paper sheets frothing around my face as I struggled. Or at the point at which I could no longer move at all, not even to gesture that I was thirsty, that my head hurt, that I needed the toilet. Our house was a 20-minute drive from the hospital, and my parents had two other children who needed to be fed, cared for, taken to and from school as normal. It was term time and my dad had to go to work. One or other of them came every day to be with me, but there were stretches of time when I had to get used to being alone. But it was a strange, unsettling kind of alone because a nurse was stationed beside my bed 24 hours a day for whenever my parents weren't there. She fiddled with monitors and thermometers and occasionally shot out of her seat to check my pulse. Other sick children, I knew, were in the ward down the corridor. This row of rooms, faced on one side by a car park filled with late summer sun, and on the other by windows with inaccurately rendered cartoon characters, were a whole other story. When you're a child, no one tells you that you're going to die. You have to work it out for yourself. Clues may include your mother crying but then pretending not to, your siblings being kept away from you, doctors looking at you with an expression of concentration, gravity, and a certain fascination. Nurses avoiding your eye. Relatives travelling great distances to visit you. Hospital isolation rooms, invasive procedures, and groups of medical students are also reliable signs. See also great presence. The part of the brain that governs motor control, the cerebellum, is tucked in at the base of the skull, under the cerebral hemispheres. It does not initiate movement, but plays a crucial role in its coordination, timing and precision, receiving and processing messages from the spinal cord and other sensory parts of the brain. It also has some involvement in cognitive functions, such as language and attention, as well as the regulation of fear and pleasure responses. In appearance, it differs from the rest of the brain. It is covered with fine, parallel grooves whose textures bring to mind the throat of a blue whale. The cerebellar cortex is one continuous layer of tissue folded into tight accordion pleats. Deep inside these folds, numerous neurons are arranged in a regular formation which give the cerebellum its enormous signal processing abilities. Our brains are a mass, a web of interconnecting cells which are lit up like strings of fairy lights by communication. We are, at our very core, in our very essence, animated by circuitry, by the transmission of information. Human brains have upwards of 100 billion nerve cells, or neurons. These, if looked at via a powerful microscope, resemble nothing so much as a tree with a trunk, the axon, branching out into numerous filaments, the dendrites. The axon trunk of one neuron fits between the branch dendrites of its neighbour. The gap between is called a synapse. Neurons zap messages to each other at lightning speed across these gaps or synapses via minuscule electrical currents. Every single thing we do or say or react to is a result of neurons passing along electricity. If these neuron cells fail to communicate, if the electrical currents between axon and dendrites stop working, if the synapses don't conduct, for whatever reason, injury, illness, age, a stroke, a virus, your body does nothing. It falls silent. It comes to a stop, like a clockwork toy that has wound down. Damage to neurons, axons, dendrites and synapses in the cerebellum results in disorders in fine and gross movement, motor learning, eye movements, balance, posture, speaking, reflexes, an inability to judge distances, and to know when to stop. Long-term effects of cerebellar damage may also include oversensitivity, impulsiveness, irritability, ruminative and obsessive behaviors, deregulated responses to fear, sensory deficits or acuities, disinhibition, dysphoria, a profound state of unease or dissatisfaction, sleep disturbances, migraines, visuospatial disorganization, tactile defensiveness, sensory overload, and illogical thought. The word cerebellum is Latin for little brain. Because I am only 8 and not much spoken to by doctors, beyond them asking me, do you feel that? Can you do this? Are you able to follow the path of this torch? I must develop new methods of interpretation. I am aware that there is a great deal being said outside in the corridor, along phone lines, behind closed doors, in the scribbled notes at the foot of my bed. I become instead a listener, a witness. I glance from the faces of my parents, standing on one side of my bed, to those of the doctors standing on the other. I learn to be alert to nuance, to inflections of brows, to minute alterations in facial expressions, to the setting together of teeth, the gripping of fists, to my parents' effortful, watery smiles. I search for meaning in the gaps between words, between questions, in the hesitations before the doctor's answers, in the way they all look down at me before moving towards the door and talking outside the window. I gather, from all the listening in, that I am to have what is called a CAT scan. The name of it is a comfort to me, conveying as it does, fur, paws, whiskers, a long and curled tail. It will, from what I can glean, take photographs of my brain, and these will tell the doctors how to make me better. I like the sound of this CAT scan. The photographs, some manner of feline involvement, the making better. When the day finally comes, I am taken on a great trek through the hospital. I am pushed in a wheelchair by the orderly I like, the one with curling yellow hair and tales about her budgies. We travel along corridors and through doors, up and down in lifts, the pediatric wards left far behind. We are in the main hospital, where grown-ups sit in chairs, where automatic doors swish open and closed, letting in jets of outside air, where people stare at me, then look quickly away. I haven't seen myself in the mirror for a long time, but I get the sense, as I'm wheeled along, that I no longer look the way I used to. And now I'm being lifted from the wheelchair onto a gurney, and everybody is leaving the room, the radiologist, the orderly, the porters, everyone. I think I call out at this point, say, "Where are you?" But my words are lost because the gurney seems to be moving, and I too am moving. There is an electronic whine, and I am being slid inside the dark mouth of a large grey machine. My head, my shoulders, my chest are inside. I am encased in a narrow grey tube. My hips, my legs. I am being swallowed by a monster. I am trapped. I am in its gullet, and I will never get out. Then a noise starts up, a deafening mechanized roar. I am in the eye of its storm, imprisoned by shining grey plastic. I scream, of course. Who wouldn't? The scream doesn't register a sound, though, because the noise of the CAT scanner is so great. I recall the urge, stronger at this point than any other, to struggle, to fight, to move, to kick my way out of that tunnel and off that gurney, and to run out of that room, down the corridor, and through those automatic doors. But I can't. I can't move. My limbs don't obey my brain, my synapses, my neuromuscular signals. My brain isn't speaking to my muscles. They have fallen out. They ignore each other. They turn away. They pretend the other isn't there. I must have moved a bit, however, in my panic, because all the people come back into the room. They haul me out. The orderly holds my hand as they discuss over me what to do. Restraints are the answer. Aged 8, I don't know what restraints are, but moments later straps are tightened over my legs, my middle, my shoulders, my forehead. This time I am screaming before my head is even in the tunnel. The orderly with the yellow hair returns. She explains to me that I need to be still in order for the pictures of my brain to be taken. I sniff, clutching her hand. I understand, I say. Yes, I understand. But it's no good. As soon as I sense the tunnel approach, I cannot countenance it. The idea of lying inside that close, grey, airless space is too much. Again, I am hauled out. More discussions. The radiologist looks at his watch. The orderly is dispatched to fetch someone. Porters mill around me, but no one loosens the restraints. Please, I sob, please take them off. The pressure of the straps on my head, on my chest, is unbearable. I can feel it now as I write this. I become, in this strange room filled with people I have never met, what my mother calls beside myself. I wail in a voice that is hoarse, unrecognizable. Panic pounds me like sea on a harbour wall. My heart races, trips and races again. It feels like the end of everything. The people in the room shift uneasily, fiddle with charts, with blinds. They are not used to dealing with children, especially distressed ones. They are radiologists, machine operators, graph producers, results analyzers. They have no idea what to do. They edge away to the corners of the room, clearing a space around me. Tears run from my eyes down the side of my face and collect in my hair. The orderly hurries in. She has a nurse with her. She exclaims. She mutters soothing noises. She pats my shoulder. She doesn't look me in the eye when she says that everything is going to be fine, so I don't believe her. And as it turns out, I am right not to. The older nurse is inverting a syringe, filling it with a clear fluid. How did I know to fear it? No! I scream, filled with a new, nameless terror. No! 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 I tell them, I'll be good. I promise I'll lie still. They inject me anyway. Sedation is, I discover, only skin deep. It covers you in a hot, suffocating rush, as if you're being swaddled tightly in a thick blanket. It makes you unable to speak, to articulate, to communicate. Your tongue lolls behind your teeth. Your eyes look out from deep inside your skull. Sensation departs from your limbs, from the outer inches of your body. But inside? Inside, the panic and fear still swarm. Just in a smaller space. I am rolled into the CAT scan. The whole length of me lies encased in the grey coffin, its roof inches from my unmoving face. The machine rotates and grinds about me. I am shunted forwards. I am shunted backwards. When I emerge, the orderly is waiting for me. She lifts me into my wheelchair. The nurse helps her as my body has lost all tension. It slumps like a corpse, heavy, unwieldy. As she settles me into the chair, tucking a blanket around me, I see that she is crying, her face scored with wet trails. The CAT scan results are inconclusive. I am given a second the following week. This time my mother comes with me. She is allowed to stand in the room, donning a huge elephantine robe to protect her from the radiation. She holds onto my foot while I am inside the machine. The results are, once again, inconclusive. A year or two ago, my mother gave me, among other things, a buff envelope labelled M's Certificates. It had been in her attic, stored in a box of stray, forgotten possessions, and I didn't bother opening it for a while. Its worn corners and brittle sticky tape exuded no urgency. When I did look inside, I found my O grade and higher results. piano exam certificates, a piece of paper telling anyone who might be interested that I had completed a level 2 module in touch typing, a document attesting second prize in the poetry section of the school I studied. Interleaved with these testaments to accomplishments, to the hours and hours I spent practicing at the piano, I also found a letter I had never seen before. It was headed in the dragon red insignia of a hospital in Wales and was addressed to whom it may concern, and was written by the consultant who had overseen my initial hospitalisation and then, months later, my gradual inching recovery. I remember him as a genial man with wiry ginger hair and a dry and careful touch, a row of pens in his pocket, an astute gaze. He was calm with my parents, with me. He would, on occasion, lapse into Welsh and call me Cariad, love. I had monthly appointments with him for years until I moved away from Wales, aged 13. I would sit on the edge of his couch and we would chat, and he would tap at my knees to see if my reflexes were still inhibited. If they still swung side to side instead of back and forth, they always did and still do. He would ask me how school was, and I would shrug, and he would glance at me without saying anything. He would bring in a group of student doctors, line them up, display my best moves to them. My pendular reflex trick, my inability to touch my finger to my nose, my unreadable handwriting, my lack of balance. Then ask them what had happened to me. I felt sorry for those nervous youths as they glanced from me to him, fiddling with their shiny stethoscopes, and I was often tempted to mouth cerebellar damage at them, or ataxia, just to help them along. It is his signature at the bottom of the yellowed letter, written on a typewriter, which details the skeleton outline of what happened to me. I wonder, as I study the letter, for whom it was intended. Who exactly would be interested in such details, the dates and phases of my illness? Who were the people concerned? Was it for me, as an adult, an account of what had happened to me, unadorned, unembellished from its actual time? Was it for other medics, specialists, doctors I might come across later in life who might wonder why I can't walk in a straight line or balance on one foot or orient myself among objects? There is always a moment when I encounter someone in the medical profession, a physiotherapist, a midwife, a fertility specialist, a practice nurse, an osteopath, an optician, an anaesthetist, when they will be examining whatever part of me is relevant, and an expression of puzzlement will cross their faces. They might lift a limb and flex it wonderingly back and forth. They will puzzle over why the reading glasses they have prescribed for me make me stagger and lose balance. They will not believe me when I say that I consume 0 units of alcohol per week. Something about me will seem unusual, off, inexplicable, and they will glance at my notes, then back at me. I have to clear my throat and take a deep breath. The thing is, I begin, and then I relate to them, in brief, in essence, the contents of this letter. Writing about this is hard, not in the sense that it is a difficult time for me to revisit. It's not that it's unwieldy or painful material to think about or mould into sentences and paragraphs. It's more that the time I spent in hospital is the hinge on which my childhood swung. Until that morning I woke up with a headache, I was one person, and after it I was quite another. No more bolting along pavements for me. No more running away from home, no more running at all. I could never go back to the self I was before, and I have no sense of who I might have been if I hadn't contracted encephalitis as a young child. The experiences you live through while gravely ill take on a near mystical quality. Fever, pain, medicine, immobility. All these things give you both clarity and also distance, depending on which is riding in the ascendant. I recall my encephalitis in its most acute phase, in flashes, in staccato bursts, in isolated scenes. Some things are as raw and immediate as the moment they happened. These I can inhabit as myself in the first person in the present tense, if you like. Others I have almost to force myself to confront, and I watch them as I might a film. There is a child in a hospital bed, in a wheelchair, on an operating table, there is a child who cannot move. How can that child ever have been me? Of its aftermath, the rehabilitation, I have a stronger sense. The coming home from hospital, the weeks and months of being at home in bed, drifting up and down on currents of sleep, listening in on the conversations, meals, emotions, arrivals and departures of family life below. The visitors who came bearing books and soft toy animals, and once, a man from over the road bringing a basket of baby guinea pigs, which he let loose in my bed, their tiny, clawed, panicked pink feet skittering up and down my wasted legs. Convalescence is a strange, removed state. Hours, days, whole weeks can slide by without your participation. You, as the convalescent, are swaddled in quiet and immobility. You are the only still thing in the house, caught in stasis, a fly in amber. You lie there on your bed like a draped stone effigy on a tomb. As the only sound you hear is that of your own body, its minutiae assumes great import, becomes magnified. The throb of your pulse, the rasp of hair shaft against the cotton weave of your pillow, the shifting of your limbs beneath the weight of blankets, the watery occlusion when eyelid meets eyelid, the sylvan susurration of air leaving and entering your mouth. The mattress presses up from underneath, bearing you aloft. The drink of water waits beside your bed, tiny, silvered bubbles pressing their faces to the glass. Distances that used to appear minor, from your bed to the door, the stretch of landing to the loo, the dressing table to the window, now take on great, immeasurable length. Outside the walls, the day turns from morning to lunchtime to afternoon to evening, then back again. Later, I could be carried downstairs where I might lie on the sofa under a blanket watching the birds swoop from leafless tree to bird feeder. It was hard to stay warm that winter. Body heat is so dependent on movement and I was unable to generate either. My fingers curled into themselves, inanimate and blue. There were exercises and stretches that had to be performed to keep my muscles and tendons from atrophying. My father would wrap a glass bottle in a blanket, arrange my legs over it, and tell me to lift my ankles, pounding the floor if I managed to produce a minor movement. A man much wedded to statistics and research, he kept graphs of my progress. These he still has. Records and results, in fading green ink, numbers of millimetres, weight in grams, ankle, knee, arm and thigh. He has a sheaf of my efforts to relearn handwriting, which range from spidery illegible runes to shakily recognisable letters. Mostly, though, my sisters were at school and my father at work, so it was just my mother and me in all these empty rooms. There was hydrotherapy at a pool where I was encouraged again and again to lift my foot onto a submerged step in the hope that the surrounding water would offer the support my wasted limbs needed. There were endless sessions of physiotherapy at the local hospital. I was the only child in physiotherapy outpatients in 1981, and I loved it. The physiotherapists seemed delighted to see me each day, as were the old ladies having their arthritic fingers coated in white wax, the elderly men recovering from strokes, squeezing rubber balls in weakened hands, lifting ankles weighted down with kilogram beanbags. "There you are," they used to exclaim as my mother pushed me over the lino, as if my appearance was all they had been waiting for. One day, a young man with a close-cut dark beard and zippered top wheeled himself over to me when my physiotherapist had stepped away to take a phone call. "Want one?" he said to me, dangling a gold-wrapped toffee in the air above me. He had an undulating, smooth-valved valley's accent. I said yes. He knew to unwrap it for me, and he did it with an air of unconcern, seemingly not noticing the compulsive shake of my hands as I tried to take it from him. He unwrapped another for himself. We sucked and chewed companionably for a moment, me on the floor, him in his wheelchair. "Were you always like this, then?" he said abruptly, nodding down at me. "No," I said, shifting the toffee from one cheek to the other. "I had a virus." I eyed his legs, emaciated and twisted, strapped down to the footrests of his chair. They looked like mine, limbs without muscle, without tone, pared back to skin and bone. His torso, his chest and shoulders were powerful, incongruously enormous. He was, I decided, merman in shape, human on top, tapering away to a finned fishy tail. "What happened to you?" I asked. "Came off my motorbike, didn't I?" he said, crumpling his toffee wrapper. "Broke my back, severed my spine." "Don't ever," he told me, wagging a finger at me, "get on a motorbike. If you're ever tempted, think of me." We regarded each other, and I had the sense that we were both trying to see the people we had been, those ghost selves who no longer existed, those able-bodied bipeds who never thought twice about the miracle of independent movement, who had been swallowed inside the sessile, atrophied beings we now were. I looked at him and pictured a man in motorbike leathers powering away from a village in the valleys, his beard and black hair hidden underneath a helmet, taking a corner at an angle, parting the air with speed. Did he see a girl blurred by motion, running, bolting, scaling the branches of a tree or leaping into the sea? I took his advice about motorbikes, as it turned out. I have never been on one, despite the exhortations of a petrolhead boyfriend. I don't recall the name of the bearded man from the valleys. I knew it once. He and I saw each other most weeks. He used to say, "How come you're still lying there on the floor? Time you got up, lazy bones." He flirted with the physiotherapists and called all the old ladies darling, making them blush and laugh. He made a bet with me as to which of us would be able to take a step first. I see now, of course, that it was a ruse, that he was never going to walk again, that he wanted me to get up on my feet in the full knowledge that he never would, perhaps because he never would. A black-and-white film exists somewhere, maybe in the archives of the South Wales Hospital, of me, aged 9 or 10, dressed in the kind of velour suit normally sported by inmates of Florida retirement homes, attempting, with varying degrees of success, to walk along a ward, to climb some stairs, to wield a pen. I look around at the camera and smile as if I'm appearing in a holiday film, not medical research footage. There is another a few years later, where I am lankier, more sullen, more reluctant, wearing drainpipe jeans and a shapeless woolen sweater pulled down over my hands. There are probably doctors, pediatricians, neurologists, physiotherapists out there who were shown these films during their training to teach them about cerebellar disorders. Physiotherapy outpatients, the staff and the patients I met there, are the reason I am ambulatory today. That they didn't give up on me, that they believed I was capable of movement, of motion, of recovery, when the doctors didn't, meant that I walked. If someone says you can do something, if you can see they really believe it, it puts that possibility within your grasp. "Come on," I remember the bearded man calling as I struggled to lift my knees from the mat. "You can do it," nodded the old ladies from their place at the wax machine. "Give me your hand," said the physiotherapist. "I won't let you fall." It also lulled me into a false sense of how accepted and wanted I would be, as a child who could barely walk, barely hold a pen, had lost the ability to run, ride a bike, catch a ball, feed herself, swim, climb stairs, hop, skip, a child who travelled everywhere in a humiliating, outsized buggy. I was loved there. I was special. I was accepted. I was cheered on. Everyone there wanted only the best for me. It gave me no preparation, no sense of what was waiting for me, when I eventually went back to school, where people would call me a spaz, a moron, a Joey, would demand to know what was wrong with me or what they would catch from me, where people would trip me up just for a laugh, would spit on me and pull my hair, tell me I was diseased, a retard, where the education authorities agreed to move my classroom downstairs, but not the lunchrooms. So every day, I had the choice of either going without lunch or climbing the stairs the only way I could, on all fours, like a bear, like a baby, with the whole school watching. We do what we have to do to survive. As a species, we are inventive in the face of adversity. Robert Frost said, "The best way out is always through." And I believe this to be true, but at the same time, If you can't go through, you can always go around. I ate a lot of packed lunches in the downstairs toilets, with the door locked, my feet tucked up so no one could locate me. The smell of bleach, of a certain type of paper towel, always takes me back to this. Misshapen peanut butter sandwiches, eaten alone, cross-legged on a cistern. The illness comes in and out of focus for me in adulthood. I can go for days without thinking about it. At other times, it feels like a defining event. It means nothing. It means everything. It means I have to scrawl succinct yet numerous sentences into those two small spaces on forms that ask, any other medical history? It has meant I need to explain certain things to people I spend time with, why I might fall over, or persistently drop cutlery, or knock over mugs, why I can't walk or cycle long distances, why I need to do a series of exercises and stretches several times a day. It means that my perception of the world is altered, unstable. I see things that aren't there, lights, flashes, spots or rents in the fabric of vision. Some days, holes will crackle and burn in the center of whatever I look at, and text disappears the minute I turn my gaze upon it. The floor may lurch like the deck of a ship. I can turn my head towards a noise, and my brain will confidently and suddenly inform me that instead of standing up, I am lying down, that the room is the wrong way up, that everything is not as it looks. I can turn over in bed and somehow my cerebellum won't keep up and will be left facing the other way. I have to close my eyes, press my fists to my face, breathe deeply until my brain decides to catch up with me. My 2-year-old child can knock me over with very little effort. Is it just me, I will ask my husband, or is this sofa tilting sideways? It's just you, he will answer patiently. And the ceiling isn't shaking either? No, he will say, turning a page of his book. It isn't. It means that my life has involved, for almost as long as I remember, a series of cover-ups, smokescreens, sleights of hand. I sleep with a light on, so that I don't fall if I have to get out of bed at night. I don't drink alcohol or take drugs, never have and never will, because I cannot touch anything that might affect my already shaky motor control. I stammered appallingly for most of my childhood and adolescence. I still do on occasion when confronted with a hostile voice, a sceptical stare, or the bald head of a radio microphone. I fall or stumble if I don't concentrate. When I ascend or descend stairs, I have to look down at my feet and apply myself to the task of meeting each tread. Don't ever talk to me when I am climbing stairs or negotiating a doorway. These acts require my full attention. I will never play blind man's buff, or surf, or wear high heels, or bounce on a trampoline. Tables crowded with cutlery, water glasses, jugs, vases, napkins present me with huge problems. I sit down at them with a sense of dread, eyeing them as you might a particularly challenging exam paper, with a mixture of fear, anxiety, and incipient humiliation. It is a sensory-spatial overload that can result in spilt water, dropped forks, broken glass, and peculiar disorienting inroads into my vestibular sense. Too many objects, too many demands on my faulty senses, too many things to navigate. I carry a lot of bruises, blackish-purple leopard spots down my legs and sides, from encounters with bookcases, door jams, table corners, chair legs. I dread book festival stages with steps, to fall in front of an audience, but I refuse absolutely to accept assistance. When I carry babies, especially new ones, on stairs, I do it like my primate ancestors, employing my spare hand as extra ballast. My left arm is pretty useless. It can just about hold a bag of shopping, or the hand of a child, or steer a bike or a buggy, but anything more than that is too much. I was in a Chinese restaurant with my friend recently. I lifted the teapot with my left hand to pour her a drink and missed her cup by about 5 inches. Scalding dark liquid shot out over the table, over our food, our chopsticks, our napkins, causing us both to dissolve into inappropriate laughter. Sorry, I got out. My left hand isn't much use. I see that, she replied, mopping herself down. Maybe you should just sell it. Maybe I will, I said. For sale. One useless hand. It also means I have a powerful aversion to small enclosed spaces. When my first child began to walk, I took him to a soft play centre near where we were living in London. I'd never been to such a place. It was an enormous edifice, several stories high, made up of cushioned planes and steps, spiralling slides, pits filled with brightly coloured balls. How he loved to run in his drunken sailor gait along its corridors, to climb the stairs, to dive face first into the balls. On the highest level, he was ahead of me as we ran along a neon-bright padded floor, and then he vanished into a narrow blue tunnel, speed-crawling into its shiny plastic mouth. I was just able to see his socked feet disappear. I crouched by the tunnel's mouth. I called his name. "Come back," I said. He laughed by way of reply. I straightened up. I assessed the play structure. Was there any other way to get where he was without using the plastic tunnel? No. I crouched down again. The tunnel was probably the width of 3 handspans. I would have to squeeze myself in, possibly wiggle like a snake. And it was long, longer than my body. It would take several seconds for me to reach the other side. There was my son, framed by the tunnel's exit like a creature seen at the wrong end of a telescope, and he was beckoning, saying, "Come, come." Is it terrible to admit that I still hesitated? I couldn't in that moment think of anything I would rather do less than enter that narrow plastic space, submit myself to its confines. I did, of course. Maternal love is a great force, greater perhaps than all others. When I got to the other side, I was shaking, stricken. My son patted me on the cheek and muttered what I said when I wanted to reassure him. "It's all right. It's all right." "It's all right." Coming so close to death as a young child, only to resurface again into life, imbued in me for a long time a brand of recklessness, a cavalier or even crazed attitude to risk. It could, I can see, have gone the other way and made me into a person hindered by fear, hobbled by caution. Instead, I leapt off harbour walls, I walked alone in remote mountains, I took night trains through Europe on my own, arriving in capital cities in the middle of the night with nowhere to stay. I cycled blithely along what is dubbed South America's most dangerous road, a vertiginous, crumbling, eroding track cut into a steep peak, the verge of which is liberally punctuated by shrines to those who have fallen to their deaths. I walked across frozen lakes. I swam in dangerous waters, both metaphorically and literally. It was not so much that I didn't value my existence, but more that I had an insatiable desire to push myself to embrace all that it could offer. Nearly losing my life at the age of 8 made me sanguine, perhaps to a fault, about death. I knew it would happen at some point, and the idea didn't scare me. Its proximity felt instead almost familiar. The knowledge that I was lucky to be alive, that it could so easily have been otherwise, skewed my thinking. I viewed my continuing life as an extra, a bonus, a boon. I could do with it what I wanted. And not only had I tricked death, but I had escaped a fate of incapacity. What else was I going to do with my independence, my ambulatory state, except exploit it for all it was worth? A teacher at school gave us John Donne's Sonnet 10 to study, and the poet's depiction of death as an arrogant, ineffectual, conceited despot made me smile in recognition. "Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so, nor yet canst thou kill me." This insouciance stopped the minute I had children, when suddenly I worried that my two-fingered taunts to death might come back to bite me. What if Dunn's proud, vengeful personification of death decided to return and seek recompense for all my insolence? What if it took me, took my baby? When you engender a life, you open yourself to risk, to fear. Holding my child, I realized my vulnerability to death. I was frightened of it, for the first time. I knew all too well how fine a membrane separates us from that place, and how easily it can be perforated. When I told a boyfriend a shortened version of what happened to me as a child, more in the spirit of explanation than anything else, he looked appalled, as people mostly do, and said, "You were so unlucky." I remember feeling surprised, because unlucky is the opposite of how I view it. They thought I would die. I didn't. They thought I wouldn't walk or swim or hold a pencil again. I did. They thought I would need a wheelchair for the rest of my life. The wheelchair was returned to the NHS after a year or so. They thought I would need to attend a special school. I didn't. They envisaged for me a life of limitations, institutions, incapability, dependency. I consider myself steeped in luck, in good fortune, to have avoided the fate the doctors decreed for me. I have been showered with shamrocks, my pockets filled with rabbit's feet, found the crock of gold at the end of every rainbow. I could not have asked for more from life, to have been spared what might have been. I could have died there in that hospital, but I didn't. I could have been condemned to a life of immobility, but I wasn't. I dodged a bullet. Many, in fact. I surfaced one day in hospital to find a man leaning over my bed. He had wide, spaced, staring eyes, a heavy gold chain around his neck, not dissimilar to the one our neighbour's Labrador wore, and wispy whitish hair standing out around his head. He was familiar and strange all at the same time. "Hello, hello," he said. "What have we here?" As soon as he spoke, I realised that I knew him from the television. Children would write to him with their wildest wishes. To fly an aeroplane, to look after the elephants at the zoo, to tap dance on stage, and he, like a genie, would grant them. And now here he was, at my bedside. He stared down at me with a piercing, assessing, slightly haughty gaze. I stared back in bafflement, astonishment. Years later, I will be in a traffic jam waiting in line for a red light to change, my children in the back of the car, and the news comes on the radio. The headline item is that this man's numerous paediatric hospital visits were not what they seemed. I will sit with my hands resting on the steering wheel, staring through the rain-flecked windscreen. I am shocked and yet not shocked at all. I recall the moment he turned to the nurse and said, "You can go. I'll look after her." The nurse shook her head and stayed. I listen to the newsreader for a moment, then jab at the radio to silence it. I don't want my children to hear. I don't want those words to spiral into their uncomprehending ears. Later that evening, I will call my mother and remind her that he came to see me. She will take a sharp breath and say quickly, "Where was I?" "I don't know," I will say. "You weren't there. But it's okay. He didn't lay a finger on me." "Are you sure?" "I'm sure." The nurse wouldn't leave. She stayed with me the whole time. That background figure in a white dress and hat, moving about the room behind this man with his tracksuit and his bracelets and his loud voice and his questions about how I was feeling and when I would be up and about again, and how about that lovely photo on the bedside cabinet of me in my ballet leotard. She never left the room. She shook her head when he suggested again that she leave, that she take a break. "I was on 24-hour watch," she explained. I remember her as young, sweet-faced, with a brown bun, happy to read stories to me for hours. She stayed there, hovering behind him, refusing to abandon her post. Another saviour. Another seraph in disguise. Before he left, the man gave me a book, signed by him. He tucked it in between the mattress and the metal bars around the bed. It was about making your own Halloween costumes. My mother read it to me the following day when she came to visit. Together we looked at the diagrams and illustrations and talked about what we would make when I was better. I kept it for years, that book. I followed the instructions to make a severed head out of papier-mâché, covering a balloon in strips of newspaper and leaving it to dry in the airing cupboard. Recently, going through a box of my old books to find something to read to my children, I came across the book again. I pulled it out, opened it, looked at his signature. Then I crossed the room and jammed it into the heart of the wood stove. It burnt quickly, ferociously, leaving behind a ghost of its shape in black, flaking ash. It is the strangest sensation not being able to move. It is not a heavy feeling, as you might imagine, but light. You inhabit your being as you might a house. The body is a structure within which you must live, as best you can, flitting from one wall to the next. The framework is inert, but you, that invisible interior part of yourself, are anything but. Your skin registers heat, cold, the crease in a bedsheet, the weight of a blanket, the rasp of a nightdress label. But it is nothing to do with you. Not anymore. What to do when you cannot move, when you are bedridden? How to occupy, divert, and distract yourself? I spend a long time staring at the ceiling above me, the clock on the wall, the rubber seal that runs around the door. I memorize each and every detail of the room, the way the paint on the far wall is a slightly paler shade of cream than it is on the others, the strip lighting that glows yellow at the edges and white in the center, the way the tap drips, once, twice, in quick succession, and then not for ages. I gaze out of the window, watching the sunlight thrown from car windscreens to skitter on my ceiling. I absorb the strange snippets of conversation, released like soap bubbles into my room as people flit past my windows. I am given to begging anyone who comes near to read to me. My mother spends hours narrating the tales of the Brothers Grimm, a book of Bible stories. My father favours a compendium of Irish folk tales. I lie there and consider Moses afloat on a river, coming to rest in a bank of reeds. David selecting the perfect stone with which to load his slingshot. Finn McCool's clever wife, Una, breaking the teeth of a rival giant with an iron griddle, hidden in a loaf of bread. Eventually, a neighbour lends a selection of story tapes. Never have I seen such things before. A solution at last. A tape player is set up beside my bed, and I can listen to Felicity Kendall reading My Naughty Little Sister, and a rather sonorous male voice intoning the tales of Beatrix Potter. Lettuce has a soporific effect. He wore his galoshes. Jemima was a simpleton, but neither of them made any remark. I roll these words around my head like pebbles. I repeat them to myself. I tuck them away. I listen to the tapes over and over again, often at night time, when the hospital is filled with that curious humming, almost quiet, when the nurse's shoes squeal on the floors, when the dark from outside reaches in through the slits in the blinds, when the hands on the clock opposite my bed leap and stop. The bad part is when the tape finishes and clicks off with a mechanical thunk, and I must wait until someone comes to turn it over for me. The awfulness of the silence, then, its crushing, rushing stillness. On such a night I am awake. My watching nurse has said that no, I cannot listen to another side of a tape. I must sleep, she says. I need to rest. My headache pulses away, a bright, demonic metronome. I look out, always, from behind its blinding white mask. The noise of the television from the ward has ceased, so I know it is late. It is deep into the night. Am I falling into sleep or something else when I hear the noise in the corridor outside? Footsteps, the fluting voice of a child, a rhythmic noise like a toy being dragged along the lino. The child says something in a high, inquiring tone, and the nurse tells him to be quiet. Hush, she says. There's a little girl dying in there. I inserted a scene like this into my third novel. I recast it, reimagined it, repositioned it. It was the only time, until this, that I ever put anything to do with my encephalitis into writing. I made the girl in the bed into the sister of the protagonist. I made the child outside into a little boy pulling a toy train. I made the nurse beside me jump up, embarrassed and shocked, to shut the door. I used to read it whenever I did public events for the book, which strikes me now as an odd choice. Why did I do that? Why read a scene drawn from what is possibly one of the worst moments you could ever live through? A child learning they are dying. Like Nina in my novel, I did think for a moment about the dying girl, how old she might be, how old you had to be to die. I felt sorry for her, and I looked over at the nurse to see if she was sorry too.